Thank you for inviting me. I'm really find it a true pleasure to be here. Again, Andrew Jenness, feel free to stop me at any time, ask a question like that. As I kind of alluded to, I can run on, so I'm more than happy to talk. And it's a relatively short presentation because I know full well if I had 50 slides, we'd be here till tomorrow morning. So unscheduled emergency care and urgent telehealth, we'll sort of get that to the end. As I mentioned, I'm a regional vice president of U.S. Acute Care Solutions, which is probably the largest physician-owned organization in the country. And that's not just emergency medicine across the board. We have 2,000 physicians, 1,000 APPs, 22 states, emergency medicine, skilled nursing facilities, hospitalist medicine, urgent cares, and we're expanding out. So this is a great time to actually to present this to you as we're doing some really innovative things. So, and also I just happened to have an appointment through Columbia. I got that several years ago on another job that I was doing, and because I enjoy student teaching and resident teaching. So as Brooke mentioned, this is really who I am and kind of things I did. I graduated from medical school in 94. I finished my residency in emergency medicine. I spent 2 years in general surgery thinking I was gonna be a plastic hand surgeon. Realized that I'd have to be in residency for about 9 years and decided, hey, I think I gotta get out and pay some loans and get to work. As far as places I've been, I had an 8-year stint before I was this regional vice president where I jumped around the country as sort of a fixer for my company, from little tiny emergency departments up to huge academic centers, two of which were residency programs. So did that for kind of 8 years, maybe about 12, 15 different places. So I've had the opportunity to see a lot of things. I've been a chief medical officer for a hospital, actually Corton Regional Medical Center. I'm not doing this to like pat myself on the back, just kind of give you an idea of kind of things I've kind of done. So if you had a question about an area, I'd be able to explain that to you. You thought, hey, what is this? Who is this guy? That kind of thing. I've been on a board of trustees, been a national scribe director for our company, a telemedicine startup, and also I happen to give the board exam for emergency medicine as well. This is kind of my people. On the left-hand side, thank goodness my wife would hear, the younger one on the right, it's my daughter. She actually is going to join the school for the hospitality program in the fall. So I'm very, very proud that she's going to be there. I'm so really excited. And those two on the right, very, very cold on their pads this morning. So, kind of some causes. Just I do this to kind of give an idea is that a connection with myself, with you. Say, okay, he's not some stiff, stuffed shirt kind of person. So similar things, just kind of icons if you recognize any of them. So this is sort of the environment. So there are CDC about 2 years ago, they're about 2 years behind to really tabulate all this. I'm not entirely certain why with everything linked with computers and costs and like that, but 137 million ER visits. So this is sort of the area, and this isn't just ER, it's also urgent care. So this is really kind of, this is the population that we're really gonna be talking about. So then you say, okay, only a third of these people, maybe a little over a third, get seen in 15 minutes. And that seems to me, with doing emergency medicine as I have, that seems really, really fast. I mean, anyone who's been to a emergency department, an urgent care center, I don't think you were seen in 15 minutes. I mean, maybe you were seen by a nurse in 15 minutes, but I doubt you were seen by an actual provider in 15 minutes. Now, you can really accelerate that with some process change. Here's the other thing. $3.3 trillion. Unbelievable space. So people are waiting. So 2/3 of people waiting, if you believe this, greater than 15 minutes in a space of $3.3 trillion. Incredible. So I mean, now, I'm not particularly proud of that being a physician, I have to say. But, and then I just put this little thing off the side. This is sort of the population where most of the money is being spent. So then if you're asking yourself, all right, well, there's the urgent care population. There's the people that are the walkie-talkies gonna walk in and out. Maybe you can interact with those people with computers and like that. That would be like an app or like that. But also, if you're really looking to have a huge impact on the cost of something, you gotta go for the low-hanging fruit. 10% of the population. So two-thirds of the money we're spending is spending on 10% of the population. So that's really, if you're going to go after it, that's an area also to really focus your attention. So I mentioned it's a fractured system, but there's a lot of consolidation occurring. I actually should have put a slide up that shows what happened with the ER groups. So about 5 years ago, there was probably 30 big emergency medicine groups. Big, defining how, if you want to kind of put those air quotes big, anywhere from maybe like 10 to 200 sites. In the last 5 years, so now there's probably 10 sites or 10 companies, and really most of that is consolidated in about five companies. And that would be 700, 500, 220, or 400, 220, which is mine, my groups, and then like 50. Oh no, but I'm sorry, about 130. So really it's huge, much like banking, insurance industry, it's really, really consolidating. A lot of because of this $3.3 trillion, people trying to get a hand of this, so much money is involved with this. And then the other thing that's going for is that medicine is set up, because it's been so fractured, is a volume business where let's try to grab as much as we can, charge the crap out of it, make a lot of money out of it, not a lot, heck of a lot of oversight, and wow, what do we get? So if you go to for like United Nations and see how well is our care in the United States compared against other countries, it's not so great. Now, there's some wiggle room in that where people say that one of the criteria is how do you feel about your care? Very subjective. If you carve that out or remove that, suddenly US system is one of the best in the world. So then what do people want? Like, what do you want from your care? I mean, so that's where all the money is. Then the question is for anyone that's going to be trying to jump into this space, asking really what the consumer wants. This is why I'm so excited to actually get involved here at Cornell. Because for myself, this is talking with people, thought leaders in this that are outside of medicine. Because where it's like any kind of industry, you can get very insular in your ideas of what people want. And then when you ask, you actually get around to asking them, you find out, no, I don't want that. So what, ask yourself, what do you really want? I want an easy process. I want it to be quick. And I don't want a lot of anxiety in this. Because when you're sick and you don't feel good, there's a lot of anxiety. Even your most stoic person is going to have that. So my chief medical officer talks about quotes. He likes quotes. I don't have a lot in here. This is probably my only one. My chair of my company talks about this. This is why actually my company does what it does. Because we could have just given up and just sided with a couple of the really big groups, but we went out and we're really trying to create something different. Who said this? Anyone know? Steve Jobs. So, and that this was, he said this when he was forming Apple. So again, this is I think this is probably one of the, like, the innovator's quotes, a disruptor quote, and why just jump in? Now my group's getting big enough, now we are becoming one of the Navy, so it is what it is. But trying our very hardest not to be those type of people. So it wouldn't be anything better than this is the space, so we've now sort of set the stage for this area. So disruptive innovation. There is a lot of opportunities here. It's a ton of opportunity for anyone who's really got an idea and has some energy and wants to go after this. Is that skilled nursing facilities, so to give you a sort of an idea of like how kind of screwed up this would be. So a person's at a skilled nursing facility, supposedly being checked on, they get checked in, and they do, like that. If something happens with them, the system, the current insurance system, so let's say Medicare, is set up where the only way a person who's in a skilled nursing facility can get seen is they actually have to be seen by like a doctor in person. So there's only one place that's going to happen 24/7, and that's an ER. ER is also an incredibly expensive place to go. So every one of these people goes. So when I was a resident, you see, talking in the late 1990s, some geriatricians did a project, and the project was, we're going to try to keep people away. We're going to do everything we can to try to keep people out. And they did that for 6 months. Incredible savings, offloaded the emergency department, great program. Showed all the savings, got some people to, because it was part of also an academic center and University of Buffalo. Crunched the numbers, showed how much it was really saving, presented that to New York State and said, hey, thank you very much for saving the money, but we're not going to change anything in our cost structure to do this. So what do you think happened the next day? All those patients showed up in the emergency department. So another, this is an example of where, how can we figure out? So now one is, you got to, we have an idea, but then how are we going to actually align that with national? Now, things are coming, are improving. Let's jump 20 years forward, we're still struggling with how are we going to actually manage that. The office visit. People talk, I mean, I'm sure maybe your grandparents or someone refers to, thinks about the office visit or something like that, the people actually went and saw people at home. This is another real, now with telephones, smartphones, apps, whatever, this is an opportunity here. Rural medicine. I don't see him in the room, but there was someone I met last year that's from, I think he's from Louisiana. And the conversation we had was about telemedicine, was, so for how can you figure out a way to get care to rural communities? Again, you think about it, okay, it's great to be in New York City, Chicago, name your favorite big metropolitan area that has a, let's say Boston, that has a subspecialist of a subspecialist of a subspecialist for whatever condition, but if you're in wherever, you got problems. I mean, if you really need, if you have some interesting, different disease that no one's really heard of, and you got to go to somebody who's never heard of that, I mean, your care is not going to be as good. It's like that. It'll be very good for the basics, pneumonia, hip fracture, you know, whatever like that, simple stuff. But if you have something really, really narrow disease, you either have to, you have to move. You got to move. If you have, say your kid, 2 years old, has some different, very, very rare disease, you can't live where you currently live. You got to move yourself, find another job, get yourself to whatever that area. If you have a children's hospital like that, because there's no really, you have no other options otherwise. Community centers, this is actually goes to this, goes with this, this rural was that he and I had this conversation where in, say, for the rural South, a major area of community is churches. So they're in the community centers. So how about if not everyone can afford like an iPad or something like that, or a computer, whatever it is. So just put them at the community center. Now on Sunday or Saturday or whatever, they, when they're having their services, now I have an opportunity now to go there. Someone could be available on call, so maybe whatever their issues are, they could take care of all those people, bam, like that. So an area of possible expertise. Disaster medicine, maritime. So again, you're on a ship and you need a specialist, you got problems if you can't be flown out or if the weather's terrible. And you think helicopters, just think about a helicopter and just how sketchy that, that travel is. If there's any problems with the weather, they don't fly. So now your care level, you have, now they have on the really bigger ships, they have physicians and PAs and nurse practitioners, but if you're in something smaller range, they don't have that. Urgent care centers and primary care offices. The other thing would be like, so in my care. So let's say I'm taking care of someone in the emergency department and they just send everybody. They just send everybody when they have any question because they're a little worried. How about an opportunity, a phone call away to this person to stay where they are? Or maybe even have that consult between the primary care physician, the patient, the physician, all at the same time. And then say, oh yeah, you gotta send them over, send them over anyways, but you already had a conversation, so you have an idea. So the loss of data. If you ever have the opportunity to look at an EMR, a hospital EMR, you will be aghast at how bad they are compared to like just your phone. I mean, you can do more on your phone than I can do with an EMR at the hospital. It is, so again, it's just another, there's a lot of reasons for that, but most of them are bad. So let's get on to, so all disruptors really need to consider. So it's going to try to change gears from, again, the kind of the where we are, what medicine is like this. So resource realignment, some operational efficiency, and process improvement. This is kind of the boring stuff, so I apologize. So resource realignment. So this referral system, so a medicine is set up on a referral system. So you see your doctor, then your health insurance typically requires a referral to somebody else. ERs were sort of carved out as this, well, this catch-all miscellaneous area. If someone says it's an emergency and your doctor says it is, and your doctor could be really a provider, is what we really should refer to, a nurse practitioner or otherwise, then you find you can go. So urgent care centers, retail clinics, telemedicine, trying to keep people out of the emergency department because it's expensive. But it's a funny thing when, like, if you watch the news, you would think that all the money that we're having is hemorrhaging in the ERs. Like, get back to that 10% of people, 65% of the money spent, that's really spent on chronic care. Really 2% of our dollars is spent in the emergency department. Of all that money, only 2% is really. And in that, for that 2%, we can get more done in 3 hours than your primary care physician can get done in 2 weeks. So is it really that expensive? It's probably not. Now, that's not saying I don't want anyone to show up to ERs. We're already totally, utterly overwhelmed. But still give an idea when people say that ERs are the problem, or you see some news show or like that. It's just, it's easy to, it's an easy place to go to start a story, and it's relatively sexy because we got a TV show, and so and people have been to emergency departments, and they had whatever, many people have had a bad experience. Most people don't, because most people live and are fine, and they leave, and they're happy, and we take care of them and like that, you know, 99% or more and like that. But still, it's an easy kind of thing to sort of, we're very used to getting kicked. And then triaging patients. Now, I use this word, so triage is trying to select out people, where you're going to put them and like that. This really isn't that. This is more like this resource realignment, sectioning, where you're going to put people and like that. So you have the low acuity patients, someone who has a cough. Pre-hospital, so your ambulance. You could put a monitor, a video, or audio right on. And we do audio all the time with the paramedics, but you could actually put a camera, one-way and a two-way visualization. So now someone's coming in, you could talk with them. Maybe that person really doesn't have anything all that terrible, and you can redirect them someplace potentially. That's really tough. Skilled nursing facilities. That's what the SNF is. Sorry for the abbreviations. Medicine, we have unapproved abbreviations. So this would probably be, well, this might be an approved one, but we try to avoid abbreviations because then all kinds of problems occur when we do that, like mistakes and like that. Specialist referrals to underserved areas, we talked about that. And then the ambulance-based teleconsultation. So process improvement. I mean, if you're gonna end up trying to get someone's attention, thinking about this resource realignment, how are you gonna figure out a way to automate some processes. So we have automation, so scheduling your referrals. I think in the last year was the first time I was actually able myself to schedule an appointment on my phone to see my doctor. You know, 2018, first time, I mean, really? You know, I could have scheduled Genius Bar 5 years ago. I can book a flight to wherever, pick your, you know, Philippines. I could do that on my phone a year or two ago. You would think you'd be able to do that. So it's coming, which is great. Telehealth, we've talked about. And then patient text messaging. So you think, okay, it's just texting back and forth, but there's all so many other things you can do. So you could do thinking, just checking in with them about how did you, congestive heart failure is an example of that. The reason why people keep coming back to the emergency department for congestive heart failure, they have problems with congestive heart failure. What that means is that someone, for whatever reason, they can't get rid of the water that's in their bloodstream. They can't get rid of it. For whatever, there are multiple reasons for that, but they basically can't do that. So they fill it full of water. When you fill it full of water, it starts to fill up actually into your lungs. And if it fills up into your lungs, you can't breathe. It's bad when you can't breathe. So they come to the hospital and we give them medicines, and often they have to be admitted to the hospital. Very, very expensive. However, if you have an interaction with someone, you can say, hey, did you check your weight? Because water, you know, as you gain weight, as you gain water, your weight goes up. So just reminding people, do you check your weight today? Do you check your weight every day? Did anything change? Okay, your weight went up by a pound. Well, it's not normal unless you chow down on a bunch of cookies or ho-hos or something like that for your weight to go up in a day, and that would even be really weird. It's probably all water. So take a little extra medicine to help you urinate more, get rid of it. You just prevented, potentially by doing that interaction like that, you just prevented admission. In an average admission, probably somewhere between $10,000 and $15,000 a person. So for that condition. And that's just if they just showed up. They just showed up and they're simple. So like 1-2 days in the hospital, 1 day in the hospital is probably about $5,000. Okay, probably more than that. It's probably gone up. So a couple days, you go to the ICU, you're really sick, maybe just one stay, $50,000. Lots and lots and lots of money here. That's where that $3.3 trillion comes from. So there's a lot of ways you can figure out using phones. And I mean, I was astonished 5 years ago when we started this telemedicine I had people who are like snowbirds, like in their 70s, who are like have starting up their iPads and what a thing, and around them, I'm like, wow, like, this is really, really great, Grandma. I'm really impressed. Okay, whereas I have other people that are younger that are struggling, having all kinds of problems, can't set it up. So, I mean, not to malign, not to malign older people, but man, I'm like, this is really, really great. The ways, again, I was just really impressed at how easy it was, how easy the devices are, and that was just 5 years ago. Operational efficiency, so scheduling initiatives, like I mentioned that, advanced access, so setting up before some, that could be in many ways you could think of advanced access. That could be setting up an appointment is one way. Also, it could be maybe I talk with someone before they arrive and have an idea what's going on to them. And then aligning supply to demand. So it's, so if someone says, I want to go to this place, but they, and because my doctor's there. But maybe they're well enough that they don't, so let's say ER-wise, I mean, ER-centric, urgent care, whatever, being able to say to them, so the 911 system would say being better in some fashion, to be able to direct them someplace else, rather than, or for that matter, let's say you have five hospitals in your area, one's getting completely overwhelmed and crushed, and but people are still going there, as opposed to say, hey, this place, they're fine, why don't you go there? You can see them quicker, and then aligning that type of care. Telehealth, so let's kind of change gears into this. This is totally in its infancy right now. This is a disruptor waiting to happen. Like I mentioned, 5 years ago, we started up, I started up a group, sold it to another group. I didn't really so much like that group just because of the kind of setup and the way that they just interacted with their providers. So I took a hiatus from them. Now we're back in, we've set up, my group has set up a relationship with this company again, 2 years forwards. And we're trying this again. And I think I was supposed to have a shift on the weekend. It didn't work out. We had some issues just with technology. Those supposedly resolved. So I'm back in this space again. So it's in its infancy states. Now, medicine is another one. They have these fractioned things because of all the way that our government is set up. So if you want a license, so I have 43 state licenses. So there's 51 possible areas you can get licenses. So because of District of Columbia. So you have to have, if you want to practice medicine in a jurisdiction, you have to have a separate state license. So there's no such thing as a national license. So I got to have 43 licenses. I got to maintain every one of them. So the process of doing that in order to do telemedicine, and because if I'm caring for you, say if I use telemedicine in California, I got to have a license in California because that's where you are, not where really where I, it doesn't matter where I am. It matters where the patient is. So asking yourself, so states don't really know what to do with a lot of this and they're struggling. Some are incredibly antagonistic to it because they have physicians on their medical boards that are worried, apprehensive, bless you, are apprehensive about what this means to them in the future. And you go to an emergency department, try to get an appointment to see your doctor, you can't get in quick, you're waiting. So I think there's more than enough business to go around for everybody here, but they're still apprehensive that someone's gonna be taking their cheese. And because of that, physicians are skeptical, apprehensive, people don't really know how to use it. Sorry, go ahead.
Along those lines, are you seeing your experience like any on the payer side, billing for telehealth, you know, codes with the modifier, like any of that contributing to the?
They're really struggling with it too. So it's not just states, everyone is struggling with this, is that what does this really mean? How do we do it? The places that have been successful with this, and we were for this startup, was is that we went direct to the either to companies, actually it was more to companies that were self-insured. So if you go to a company that, there's different ways you can set up your healthcare. So if you buy healthcare as an individual, you may get it through Anthem, Cigna, United, like that. So you're an individual who gets it. I'm not certain how Cornell does it, but I suspect that what Cornell does is they probably take everybody's money, aggregates it, and then they find your insurance may say like Blue Cross on it, but they're really more administering your money, or administering Cornell's money, I should say. We could go to Cornell and say, hey, we will cover all your lives. You pay a set fee, tiny amount, and then there's a subscription cost, like people pay as they use it, that kind of thing. Insurers are really struggling with this. The government, which is 35, which is a lot of this pay has come out, there are paying a lot of it. They're not really even sure what to do with it yet. The government's growing slow, so everyone kind of follows what they're doing. Some people are trying to do it, but a lot of it really is, again, fractured. That's the problem with this. Any kind of change you want to make in a system is, and because there's so much at stake, so much money at stake, it's slow going. And it's the big ship turns very, very slowly. Let's see here. So this is the other great thing about telehealth. It's in the eye of the beholder. And you could drop down to the bottom left. Peloton could be considered telehealth. I mean, so think to yourself, it's not just you saw your doctor, it's not you saw a PA, it's not this maritime like I mentioned. It could be one of the hardest things for any real physician is dermatology, is that because you don't see enough, you see a lot of hives, you see a lot of cuts, things like that, but you don't see a lot of rashes. So dermatology, huge opportunity for dermatologists here. The pre-hospital I mentioned, rural, maritime. So I think yoga could be considered telehealth. You could very well walk some, give an anecdote from telemedicine days, that person comes in and says, I fell on my wrist hurts, do I need an x-ray? Like, wow, I mean, I really need to touch you to determine if you're needing an x-ray. You actually don't. You can have, hold up your hand. So you think the other things it could be, like yoga or your whatever analogy, said, okay, hold your hand up, move your fingers. These are the important areas. If you had a pain here, or you had pain here, or you had pain or tenderness, I should say here, you need an x-ray. Person moves around, can you move it around fine? Yes, okay, tenderness in these areas. Then there are some scary spots that could develop into some problems 2-3 weeks later, months later. You can walk someone through an examination. We have an associated group that's called Dispatch Health, and that this is that they have people where they put up, they have like a Prius that has in the back that has all kinds of healthcare aides. So if it sounds to the 911 operator like it's a low acuity patient, they send this person out to them. They can check them out. Nurse practitioner or PA is out there, checks them out, says, "Oh, I think this is kind of minor kind of thing. Maybe you just need some of this medicine I mentioned because your weight went up 2 pounds. Help you that." But then we were talking with the telemedicine, could we do this? I use the wrist example. I say, oh yeah, you do need an x-ray. Well, 5-10 minutes, okay. I'll finish up with that. This should be actually be at the end of this. And then how about instead I send a mobile x-ray device to you? Okay. And then the x-ray is positive. So I could send this person, this Dispatch Health, to you to put a splint on you. You never had to leave your home. So it doesn't have to be always coming to the center. You could decentralize it. And really the value of this telehealth is reducing hospitalizations, this cost savings I mentioned, and really, really improving some of the nurse skills, and then integrating with a care team. Okay. Oh, I got it. Okay. All right. There you go. Look at that. Okay, look at that. So, this presentation is, you're welcome to it, so as far as for notes and like that, it is intentionally kept the way I do. I'm not a huge slide guy. I like to talk with people, and I want people really staring at slides. I had someone, a mentor, said, but you gotta give them something. I said, well, okay, I'll give you something. And there is a bit of a bibliography here at the end. It's amazing what PowerPoint designs can do, so I kind of played around with it. And this one's kind of boring, but it's kind of interesting what it'll let you do here. And these articles, some of them you may have to buy. I suspect that from Cornell that you should be able to get them, whatever, through the medical school, should be able to find some of these articles. And Joseph has this presentation, so you don't have to, if you want to take pictures, you can and like that, but you're welcome to just get the entire presentation. So I think that is it. Yes, questions? Thank you.
So I have some of the prepared questions.
Oh, all right.
We'll do a couple of those.
All right, cool.
So how do you stress the importance of preventative measures as you work?
So,
put that question out there. This is so mysterious because people send their questions and I say, who made the question? And nobody knows that.
Okay. Just actually go ahead and repeat the question for me one more time. Sometimes I hear what I want to hear and I'll go off.
How do you stress the importance of preventive measures as you work?
So as far as on the job, it's kind of rolling through with the person. I mean, so it's most of the preventive things you can really do are going to be smoking, are going to be if what their disease specific issues will be, like following their diet, maybe it's their fluid intake, mentioning this congestive heart failure like I mentioned, trying to avoid sugar. I mean, obesity is a huge problem. I mean, a lot of the issues that we have in medicine are related to lifestyle as well. So it's part of the conversation during with the patient, trying to mix it in there. I mean, you don't want to seem like you're lecturing people. People just turn that off very, very quickly. If they think that you don't have their best interest in mind. It's really the art of medicine is that connection. If I can make that, and the big issue with let's say emergency care is that I don't have a lot of time. So I have to figure out ways to engage people really quickly. And there are kind of tricks to it. One of them, let's say, well, one is, of course, the handshake, sitting down with people, laying of hands. People start to say, well, you know, with infectious disease and like that, you got to figure out a way to walking up to somebody and putting your hand on their shoulder when you're talking with them. May not seem like very much, but the engagement of that is huge. Sitting forward when you're having a conversation with somebody. Part of my group, we set up a patient experience academy. It's called something else now. And part of it was that we brought the physicians in and then we recorded them and what they did. And to see how they interacted with simulated encounters with patients in very high stress type situations. It was funny to watch ourselves. It is so funny the things you do. Knowing, in fact, I even knew what I was doing, but to watch it and see that obviously would turn somebody off. So that would be part of it.
So a question back there.
So do you think that, telehealth in general detracts from the personalized healthcare that hospitals show? So like, for example, I know a lot of people go to hospitals rather than like, you know, like looking at your own symptoms and like treating yourself in the case of like a serious effect. And also because people want personalized healthcare. And so with telehealth, doesn't that run the risk of reducing like I guess personal engagement with like a doctor or a nurse at the risk of these? And how is that a problem you foresee?
It could be a problem, but it's interesting that people don't have that problem. People don't. I think engaging people isn't, certainly being in the room with somebody is valuable, but the one-on-one encounter with somebody, if you are interested in them and you engage with them, I don't think it's necessary that you have to be in person. Is it valuable to be in person? Oh, certainly. Doing audio telemedicine, there are some groups that they'll take a phone call and listen to them. I find that exceptionally difficult. However, the visual, they can see myself, I can see them, I can pick up a lot of cues about just somebody and how sick they really are. Just like in 15 seconds looking at somebody, I can say, okay, sick, not sick. Very quickly, can do that. So for me, the video encounter, but I think for the patients also like it because it's on their time. It's when they're sick, when they want to be seen, if they're not even so much sick, they have a question. I think human engagement and communication isn't just about being one-to-one. I mean, being in person with someone, because you can be in person with someone and be completely disengaged with somebody. So I don't think it's strictly just an issue of being actually in front of the person.
The last question, so I'll start from
after.
You mentioned like there are like the provider mm-hmm. concerns, just like the stays or collisions. What are like the major concerns that consumers have with telehealth?
Consumers or the physicians and providers themselves?
Like, what are the major concerns that have shown up?
So the concerns. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No. I'm curious. What are the like major concerns about telehealth that patients have had that you guys have seen?
So, do you mean the actual diseases themselves or just worried about
how the care and how the care is given, et cetera?
Yeah, so I mean, and the trepidation with anyone that you don't know is also that the technology kind of gets us to work. And that is, who is this person who's on the other side? Where are they coming from? Are they like me? And by liking me, could just be, are they from the same state I'm in? Are they, can I understand them? That's a lot of the trepidation is that. It's like being videoed. That you think that by being videoed by something that it's going to be difficult to be videoed and it's going to be stilting and it will be a problematic in that way. But it's funny, within about 30 seconds, you just completely ignore it. Then the interaction starts. And if you actually can engage somebody, it disappears really, really quickly. So then the cue, so someone's on there, says, oh, I know this is really, really tough, this is kind of weird, But we're gonna get through this together. The person's like, oh, okay, all right. They're trying their best. They're with me here. They're trying to do this for me. Engage them very, very quickly.
Okay. Kind of on a similar note to that, I have two questions revolving around liability. So first is on that note with telecommunication. Is there any concern for that sort of information or video getting hacked or easily disposed of by various networks? At least with internet health, in my experience, there's so many portals you have to go through, and then to even like interact with someone, you have to be there in person. And then on another sort of side of liability, if you're sending physicians out and they don't have all the resources that they would have at a hospital, like an MRI machine, we talked about remote x-rays, are you at a higher level of liability because you won't be able to give every sort of care option if it's determined they need something else at their own property?
Great, great questions. So the first is that the worry of your information being captured or otherwise, one of the reasons why EMRs or these electronic health records are so bad is because of the requirements for exactly that. Because of all the extra steps you have to put in order to protect that information. So secure connections, and not just secure connections, all the other different things that I mean, I'm not an IT expert, would never even attempt to say I am. There's a lot that goes into that. That's why you have to jump around with all these different portals to do that. And then as far as the liability of the provider that's out there, I would flip that actually. I would flip that the person who's sick, who needs your care, potentially could be really, really sick. I would much rather have a person out there seeing them and then calling for help than have that person be on their own. So my group has flipped that and said, to our opinion, that like we put a provider, actually a provider out in our triage areas. People are worried that, well, someone will come in, maybe they'll leave. But the number of people that we actually capture by being out there, so having that resource out there, so the physician or the PA or nurse practitioner that has the expertise, that's seeing people as quick as they possibly can, so it may capture subtle things, I would rather actually send that provider out and take that risk, the potential risk that you described, rather than having the person maybe not get any care at all or delay the care. And not to bash or diminish what EMTs and paramedics do, but again, they don't have that level of expertise. So I would much rather, I think that we're in a much better place to send someone and call for help, and people know that. I mean, yes, I mean, I used to do some consultation work for attorneys for malpractice, and I was on the dark side. I did it for the plaintiffs. And the reason I did it for that was because it allowed me to actually prevent lawsuits. Like there was a lawsuit someone brought up or wanted to pursue something. I said, hold on here. You're talking about a situation, a rural person, PA, saw a stroke. What you think that person's, what's available at that time, as far as for thrombolysis to try to prevent that, there's no way that's available in the rural setting. So you're gonna waste your time with this. And he said, oh, okay, well definitely I'm a lawyer. I don't wanna waste my time. We're at a business and like that. So to answer that question, I'd be more worried that we didn't have people out there doing it.
This question in the back of the room.
My question was about HIPAA compliance of telehealth, but you already kind of touched on that.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty much, yeah. Again, imagine if someone pulls their phone out and they use video with you one-on-one, there's already an implied consent there that if they're gonna use their phone and they're in a crowded area, that hey, you've made this interaction. You've decided you wanna do this. Now, because it's your phone, you can then go, whatever, find some private area and like that and have that conversation yourself, but you're engaged in that. The bigger compliance for HIPAA really is someone comes into whatever the setting is and you're just start talking to them in front of others about their care. Emergency department, hallway, visits like that. Now, HIPAA doesn't prevent you from doing it, but you gotta make a good faith effort to avoid that.
Other questions?
I just wanted to have you maybe touch on the importance of telehealth for the aging populations and gerontology and the idea of people being more comfortable aging in place in their homes.
Yes. So there's something that's called sundowning. And sundowning is when you take an elderly person out of their normal setting, they go to something very strange, and they basically freak out. So, and that's because as your ability to, your facilities and your brain work, you get used to your settings, just easier. Just think of yourself, which you're at home and then versus being at a hotel. You know where your stuff is, you know where you can find whatever it happens to be, it's just easier. So then take someone who has some cognitive problems, say some dementia, and take them to another setting, and how frazzled they get. So yes, a huge, huge value for that person to be have their care right where they are, though, as opposed to actually have being moved. And the same thing goes with pediatrics. And I had this great telemedicine story where a mother called in and I said, I'm sorry, your child has to go to the hospital. She said, no, that's okay. I love the service because I got four other kids. And when I got to take my kid to the doctor's office, I'm not taking one kid to the doctor's office, I'm taking five. And when it's 2 degrees outside, that means coats on every one of them. I got to corral every one of them. I got to fill bags full of stuff for them, for food and for games and stuff. I got to pack them all up in my car, five car seats. I got to drive them to the doctor's office. They go to the pediatrician's office. They sit there, we sit at least for an hour to be seen. They're going crazy and going bonkers in this room. I see the doctor for 5 minutes, and then I got to repeat that process in the reverse. Says, you know what? This is incredible. So just thinking of that, what the opportunities in this space.
Could you share how some of the quality outcomes and capturing patient experience and value-based care, like how that applies to telehealth and how all of those metrics are captured and shared with hospital administration?
So as far as for, I'm sorry, I'm going to ask you to repeat it one more time, as I started to answer the question in my head, and then I realized at the end you had some very good points there. I'm sorry.
Sure. So in terms of like value-based care, capturing the patient experience, quality outcomes, and all of that, I'm sure from the hospital administration side, they'd like to see what are the key metrics and how success is defined. So if you could share some of the ways that telehealth actually captures all of that.
Yeah, so this volume versus value that I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, that's one is you're just grabbing everything you can, and I didn't really get into the value piece. The value piece is outcome. What actually is the outcome of people? So some groups, and my mind is one of them, entering the spaces is that, like capitated care, saying, okay, how much is the average covered live per year cost for your population? Give us all that money, the average, like that, and we'll knock, let's say, like 25% off. But that's the risk corridor there. If we, in that 25% that's left over, if we actually save you in that money, we want some of that 25%. So then creating what are then the outcome measures to actually prevent that. So you were trying to really preventing someone from showing up at the hospital. That's gonna be the biggest one. So showing up at the ER and then being admitted to the hospital. So then the outcomes are going to be mentioned, okay, you could use weight as one of them. So for congestive heart failure is one. For asthma, it could be, are you actually taking your medicine? I mean, it's maybe astonishing, but maybe 2/3 of patients, they fill their prescriptions. A third don't fill a prescription. I mean, multiple reasons for that. Maybe they can't drive. I mean, it's astonishing sometimes. You think, oh, I get great access to a car or, you know, with Uber or like that. But if you don't have $5, you may not even be able to get to the hospital, to the pharmacy to actually get your medicine. Than figuring out a way to get them their medicine, have them actually take it. Diet modification. So someone who can intervene for diabetes is a huge one. If someone can actually lose maybe 10, 15 pounds, their diabetes could potentially disappear. So a lot of this outcome is, hey, just give us this, whatever this covered live money is, and then letting us figuring out ways to do so. So from telehealth, it's like gonna be interaction with the person. So having someone drive out, I mean, if you have 20 places you gotta be in one day, now they may be all be close, maybe you're lucky in their own same apartment building, and that would be outstanding. So I'm thinking maybe for like geriatrics and a skilled nursing facility, but if your covered lives are scattered over an entire city, okay, if I can just do most, maybe I can do 2/3 of these conversations through a telehealth platform or an iPad or something like that. Wow, I mean, that may very well now allow me to expand out and do more care. So with a lot of these outcome measures are already in place. And the biggest one is really keeping people away from hospitals.
You know, but I think you gathered some data when you were doing one of those big surveys. You were asking people about telemedicine. It turned out that the older population was actually more in support of it than the younger population. Remember that?
Yes.
Result? And maybe for some of these reasons of the inconvenience of having to deal with all the challenges. Someone else have a question?
So, yeah, one of the ones that somebody brought up, I don't know who this was specifically, but how you incorporate hospitality concepts in clinical settings and you've seen a measurable impact on the effects of the IU and other kinds of things. Who put that in? Okay, great.
So the patient experience up until, well, it's been thought of, wanted to do something with it, and it's always been, well, this is, if you go to the hospital of 10 years ago, they were really the hospital that was built 50 years ago. So now people are building hospitals really thinking about people and that their lives and comfort, the comfort for them. It's not just comfort. I mean, hospitals are noisy places. They can smell. The food is terrible. So if you're already feeling poorly, just figuring out ways and then the alternatives. So just think of anything that would be hotel-like. Now that makes a lot of physicians like us cringe, but it only makes us cringe until we're the ones who are actually sick. And then we want all those things. So it's, I teach by anecdote. I had pneumonia maybe 2 years out of residency. I was on the job, figuring it out actually. And it was a late, really late night. It was really slow. And I was feeling really dehydrated. And I asked a nurse to put an IV in me. I said, I'm gonna sit in this back room and just give me some fluids. So that'll just help me, I think, with my dehydration. And I sat in this room and it was terrible. It was ugly. It was really uncomfortable. The fluids that they put in my arm were room temperature fluids. They put a gallon of basically room temperature water into my body. You put like just half of a bag of fluid into your arm that's room temperature, and your arm is like ice. It's like ice very, very quickly. I wasn't the chair of the place yet. You could be sure that things changed. Okay, the next day, the conversations that I was having is that we never gave room temperature fluids to anybody ever again. It was gonna be warm fluids. We found whatever the warmer, so they were just a little bit warmer than even your body just makes you feel so much better. That the room, we didn't have the old school, when you go see your doctor, beds a couple months later, those were gone. Whereas this hard thing, there was actually stuff, it was the boringest room in the world too. I mean, this was also the age, there was no phone, there was no smartphones. So all you had was a magazine, and there were no magazines. And well, there was maybe a magazine, it was for maybe like Kids Life or something like that. So it's like, all right, so I'm like doing the puzzles like that. I'm back there for 2 hours. Now I could walk around and leave the room if I wanted to, but man, it wasn't a terrible experience, but clearly there was not much thought of for patients and their comforts, and at least to keep them distracted.
And on that note,
thank you.